I'm back, book friends.
Welcome to Keep It Fictional, a weekly podcast for book lovers by book lovers. Build your to-be-read list with Sadie, Liz, Virginia, Fiona, and Corrine from the Port Moody Public Library. Warning, this podcast contains strong opinions and may cause an increase in your library holds list.
And welcome to Keep It Fictional, the book loving podcast from Port Moody Public Library. I am your host, Allison, and today I am joined by my book friends, Virginia, Sadie, and special guest, Liz. So the topic today is one that is near and dear to my heart. We are talking about books that involve parallel universes, alternate realities. So let's just get right into it. Let's have our special guest go first, if you're okay with that.
Thanks for having me back. It's an honor. I'm back, book friends, just for today, though. So don't get too excited here. Now, this may be a theme that's near and dear to Allison's heart. I can't quite say it's the same for me. So, you know, just to come back and be a little bit disruptive. However, I did find something that I think will be quite interesting to a wide variety of readers, because I feel that it doesn't just touch on different worlds or different realities, but also is kind of magically realistic. Anyways, I am revisiting an author that I do revisit time to time. And if you've listened to this podcast in the past, you'll probably guess that is Haruki Murakami from Japan. Now, this particular book that I'll be talking about today is called 1Q84 or 1Q84. As you may have surmised, this book does take place in 1984, and it does take place in Tokyo beginning in the spring. When this was first published in Japan, it was released in three separate volumes, three separate books, creating this massive, massive volume that was translated and released in English sometime later. It was wildly popular in Japan and got quite a bit of buzz here because of its quirky nature. Now, the book opens with a scene on the expressway in Tokyo, and traffic is gridlocked. Nobody is moving. And there's a woman sitting in a taxi, impatiently waiting. She decides to exit the taxi and keep walking on the expressway until she finds a staircase down to the lower level streets. Her name is Aomame. And little did she know at the time, but by descending those stairs, she had crossed into another dimension. At first, though, the world that she crosses into is not really much different from our own or her own Tokyo of 1984. However, Aomame's a sharp woman, and she soon discovers that things are not quite the same anymore. Probably the most obvious difference, as she discovers one night, is that there are now two moons in the sky. Strange. She decides to name this new world 1Q84. So that she can reference what this new reality is versus the reality that she knows. Q standing for question. It's all a question mark to her. Now, meanwhile, a writer named Tango takes on a unique ghost writing project. He normally has a mundane life, as you may expect, but soon this becomes anything but. Now, very unlike his usual projects, he not only becomes more and more involved with the content of the work, but also the actual person that he is ghost writing for. So, of course, it's no coincidence that Murakami puts the spotlight on these two characters, Aomame and Tango. Their lives are destined to converge. And before we know it, we realize that maybe they are not strangers to each other after all. So, of course, as mentioned, this is a fairly thick volume. So it's not just about these two characters. And in true Murakami fashion, along the way, we encounter a whole host of unique and quirky characters. Everybody ranging from a professor turned cult leader, a high school student with extraordinary powers, a wealthy dowager with a penchant for justice. So these characters all lend even more color to the story in a way that brings to life the 1Q84 world and draws us in and makes us think, you know, maybe this reality that we currently live in maybe this is not all that there is to our world. So what will happen to Aomame and Tango? Will they unite somehow? Will they make it back to the 1984 that they know to be their own reality? You might just have to read this one and find out.
Thanks so much, Liz. That sounds like a really interesting read, and it might have to end up on my TBR. My book today is V.E. Schwab's A Darker Shade of Magic. This is a reread for me. It's one that I read a couple years ago and loved. It's the first book in a trilogy called The Shades of Magic Trilogy. And this trilogy follows a man named Kel. Now, when we first meet Kel, he is in London, 1819. And he is visiting the king. The king is somewhat ill and retiring and kept in a room away from everyone else. But he is waiting excitedly for Kel's visit because Kel is from another London. Kel is from a parallel London that he calls Red London, where magic exists and runs through the city in the form of the river at the center of the city, which shines bright red, hence the name Red London. Kel is an Antari, which means that he is one of the few people who can travel between the different Londons, and his job is to carry messages between the royals of the different Londons. So he carries his message to King George. He goes and visits the Prince Regent, who he has a message for as well. And then he leaves to go to a nearby tavern. A tavern that is interesting because in all of the Londons that Kel visits, in all three Londons, there is a tavern on this spot. And it is here that we learn that Kel has a bit of a habit. And this habit is dangerous because what he likes to do is make trades. He will trade items from one London for items from another London. And this is absolutely forbidden. The doors between the Londons have been closed for a reason. But Kel just can't quite help himself. And we see him make a trade for a music box, a mechanical music box in our London, which he calls Grey London because of its lack of magic. So we follow Kel back to Red London, where we find out that not only is he an Antari working for the king and queen, but he has been adopted by the king and queen into the royal family. So we see a little bit of his tension between himself and his adoptive brother, Rye, their friendship, and the tension that he feels as a member of the royal family, but also, in his view, somewhat of a possession of the royal family. Then we cut back to Grey London, and we meet our second main character, Lila Bard, or Delilah Bard. Lila is a pickpocket. She spends her time dressed as a man in the evenings, and she goes around stealing from the rich in order to enrich herself, because she has a dream, and that dream is to become a pirate, to own her own ship, and to be a pirate on the high seas. At first, we don't see what these two characters have in common, but we cut back to Kel, and Kel is asked to go to the third London and deliver a message. This London is called White London by Kel because it is a place where magic is dying, and the retreat of magic has caused a pall to come over this place. Everything just seems pale and sickly. So he goes to visit the very dangerous king and queen of White London. And on his way back, he has decided he will no longer make these trades. He will no longer worry his brother. But a woman approaches him and says, can you please just take a letter? That's all I'm asking you. Take a letter from here to my dying family member in Red London. And I won't ask anything else. I'll even pay you. And she forces a package on him. Kel doesn't really want to do this, but before he can give back the package, before he can give back the letter, the woman disappears. And so Kel decides that delivering a letter can't possibly be too much of a problem. So he crosses back to Red London, goes to deliver this letter, but realizes that he's been set up. There is nothing written on the letter, and he begins to be chased. As he is chased, he finds that the payment he was given is a strange stone, and this stone has a mark on it, a mark that he recognizes as an Antari of the word for magic. And he realizes that this stone has come from the most forbidden London of them all, Black London, which has been sealed off for a long time to keep its corrupted magic from leaking into the other worlds. He is attacked, but he manages to escape. And he manages to escape back to Grey London, where he runs into a certain pickpocket. And from there, the story really starts. So A Darker Shade of Magic is a really fun book. It is a little bit of a period story, but it's more of a fantasy story. You get to go between all of these Londons with Kel. You get to travel. You get to have the fun of Lila's pickpocketing and her exhilarating life. And you get to see these two characters' lives intertwine and see how the magic in these worlds affects them. It's a fantastic read. I highly recommend the trilogy and hope that you'll pick it up. So now I think it's time for our existential question of the day. My existential question for everyone today is, if you could transport yourself into the world of any book, would you? And if you could, which book would it be?
I always feel like my first response to this question is yes, 100%. I would transport myself into a book because there's so many cool worlds and cool magic and other things that this world just doesn't have. But then I stop and think about all of the usually horrible things that also go hand in hand with all of the really cool things. And then I don't know if I would want to. I think that A Discovery of Witches is the book that I would transport myself into. It is it's a world very similar, pretty much exactly like ours, except it has the existence of witches and vampires and demons. And so it has that magical element without losing too much of what I'm used to and my nice comforts that I wouldn't want to give up on. So yeah, I think I'd say A Discovery of Witches and just try not to be attacked by someone.
I was kind of thinking the same thing. I'm like, none of my books end well. It's never anything good in my books. Either like everybody's already dead or like they're all gonna die. So like, I don't know if there's a world that would be safe to go to. So just for my own survival sake, maybe not. So I would say no, even though like it would be cool to be there, but no. And then if I really have to pick, I mean, I'm always gonna go back to my standard answer, TJ Klune. Like whatever world that he developed, I will go there. You know, then I can meet the characters, you know, and usually things end up eventually okay there. So yeah, I think that would be if I have to pick.
I was going to say House in the Cerulean Sea is not too bad. Not too bad of a world, right?
Maybe too hot for Virginia though. I don't know. On the island there. Gosh, yeah, I totally agree that there are definitely pros and cons to jumping into a book world, especially depending on what you read. Yeah, and I feel it's kind of a cop-out if I say, oh, I want to jump into one of those worlds that, you know, takes place in the modern time and literally, like, that's it. It's just literally in another country. I mean, I might as well just jump on a plane at that point. But if I had to pick sort of a world that doesn't currently exist, I'd probably choose to go back to Russia in the Winter Night trilogy from Catherine Arden. We're talking about a time where about all this beautiful architecture and people believe in sort of these little house gremlins and these spirits in the forest and pay tribute to them. And it's all kind of mystical, magical in that sort of a sweet fairy tale way until everybody starts vying for land and territory and power. And then the Winter King comes after you. But, you know, other than that, that sounds like it would be pretty neat. How about you, Allison?
For me, I thought about this for a while, and I think that the world that I would go into would be the world of His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman. It is a really interesting world, and I am horrifically curious as to what my demon would be. I think that being in a world where not only do you have this animal companion, but you can talk to it, you can have this piece of your soul that you can actually converse with, is such an interesting concept. And I really want to know what my demon would be. So that is our existential question. Let's get back to our books. Virginia, what book do you have for us today?
156,000 people arrive one day in Queens in New York City. They are not from here. They are from an alternate universe. A universe that has been decimated by a nuclear disaster and prompted the government to set up a lottery to determine who gets to go through the gate. The gate that is supposed to take them to a different universe. None of the people that went through the gate that day knows if the gate actually will work or not. But here they are, in a world where everything is familiar, but yet not. Like they recognize the places, for example, but where there was a park is now a shopping mall, where there were houses is now a highway. Everything is the same and everything is different. These 156,000 people will be known as the UDP, the Universally Displaced Person, and we follow two of them as they navigate their lives in the new universe. We follow Hel, short for Helen, and Vikram. They met here in this universe, they became lovers, and they live together now, and Hel was once a surgeon. And everybody says that she should just get recertified, get back to work. But Hel is not quite ready yet. Overwhelmed by this whole world, mourning the loss of her son, she just needed some time to herself. Vikram was a scholar back in the other universe. And now he has a job as a security guard at a storage facility to support himself and Hel. One night, he was working, and when he looked over at the facility, he saw a blue light. This blue light filled him with fear and also hope at the same time. He rushed towards the storage unit because he recognized this blue light. It is the same blue light that the gate gave off, the gate that took them here to this world. If there's a blue light coming from this storage unit, does that mean that there is another portal? Does that mean that people are still coming through? Does that mean that there is a way to get back? And does that mean that there's still a universe for him to go back to? He rushed up to this facility, tried to locate the storage unit that he thinks the light is coming from, but there was no more light. And this became his obsession. He needs to find out which storage unit and who owns it. Meanwhile, Hel is obsessed over something else. Staying at home, she spent her time reading Vikram's books. Now, when the UDPs came over, they were told that they were allowed one suitcase. And so Vikram brought over all his books. And that always became a topic of conversation whenever the UDPs meet together. They always talk about, what did you bring over? And among Vikram's books, there is a set of pulpy science fiction novels by an author named Ezra Slay, a famous, famous author. But in this world, there is only this one set of books. And Hel became really interested in the books because she found out that there was an Ezra Slay in this universe also, but he drowned and he died when he was 9 years old, and he never became the author that everybody from her universe knows. And so she started thinking about finding a way to remember all the people that never lived, all the objects that never existed in this universe. And Hel wants to build maybe a museum that collects all the things that the UDPs have brought over so that they can find a way to remember the world that they used to live in. She thought the perfect place for this would be Ezra Slade's house. Of course, in this universe, that is not his house because he never grew up. But she figured that that would be the perfect location for this. And so she's trying to get the person to sell her the house so that she can build this museum. And she also needs to get help on like how to do this. And so she was very lucky to be invited to a function where there were a lot of museum directors and curators and archivists. They were all gathering. And so she started pitching her idea to them to hope that some of them will find this an interesting project. Many of them sort of brushed her off, like didn't think that this is something that needs to be done. But one woman was quite interested in her idea and agreed to have her assistants meet Hel the next day at the library so that they can do some more research. As Hel was leaving the party, she felt very hopeful. She felt like finally there's a purpose in her life. There is something that she can do. But that's when she realized that the book that she brought to the party, one of Ezra's lay book that she wanted to show them as an example of something that came from her universe that never existed here. That book, she didn't have it anymore. The woman has it and never gave it back. So she tried to call the woman and say, I'm sorry, but like, I think I left the book with you. And the woman's like, what are you talking about? I don't have the book. But Hel distinctly remembers she holding it and looking through it and inspecting it. Why would this woman lie to her about not having the book? This is Famous Man Who Never Lived by Kay Chess, her debut novel. And it's really interesting to see an author using this idea of a parallel universe to tell a story. You know, very often parallel universal story involve like a individual's life diverging, you know, how they went right instead of left and then their life changes. But here, Kay Chess uses this idea to explore the new immigrant and refugee experience, what it is like to be forced to leave your home. And the twist here, of course, is that it's kind of the same world that they arrive in, that they should know this world. They feel like they should be more adjusted here, but they can't because everything is just a little bit different. And how they struggle with words, because different words are being used here for the same thing. And it's so embarrassing when you make a mistake or you use the old word to describe something and how people look at you like you don't know what you're doing. And how many of them were so skilled in what they were doing in their world, but now here, because technology was developed just slightly differently, they can't do what they used to do anymore. And it's all those subtle differences that really make life so difficult for these people and how they yearn for what is lost and that's sadness that they felt when you know that you can never go back or that there's no world to go back to. And how Hel and Vikram try so hard to work towards something to try to remember the universe that they came from. As they have to attend these mandatory weekly classes to get reintegrated, and as they are being treated as less intelligent and inferior. In addition to Hel and Vikram's main story, at the end of each chapter, we also get excerpts from interviews of the UDPs of different other people to try to show us how there's no one narrative to describe all the people that came to this universe because everyone's experience is unique. You can't just have a blanket statement describing what it's like to be a new immigrant, what it's like to be a refugee. And of course, this book also looks at how we treat new immigrants and how we treat refugees. In the beginning, everyone was fascinated with the UDPs. There's so much curiosity about like, wow, these people come from a different universe. Everybody was just so welcoming, so fascinated. And the UDPs talk about it like that people are weirdly obsessed with, like just regular things in their lives that they deem like exotic. And then, you know, sometimes the UDPs even take advantage of that to try to help them cope with what their new world demands of them. But soon the attitudes change, you know, it become condescending, patronizing. And this sort of communication barrier makes people feel like these people are less, somehow less of a human than them. And then, of course, they're met with hostility, the attitudes that these people are here to take my job. They are sucking out all the resources from our society without giving anything back. And all these sentiments that unfortunately are very real in our world too. Despite the setting of sort of this parallel universe. You don't be afraid of it because, you know, you're not going to get any science in this book. There's like really no explanation of like what the gate is, or like there's no theories about like how alternate universes work. That's not what this book is. It is very, very much about what it's like to be a new immigrant, what it's like to be a refugee, and this story of displacement. So if this is something that interests you, the parallel universe thing is just there as a setting, but it's very much about the people. So please check out Famous Man Who Never Lived by Kay Chess.
Wow, that is such a cool way to use the idea of parallel worlds. I am absolutely riveted by that concept. I'll have to check it out. So finally, we've got Sadie. Sadie, what book do you have for us today?
All right. So I took a bit of a different take on this topic. Instead of an alternate universe, I looked at an alternate history. So my story revolves around the Great Library of Alexandria. Now, in reality, it was likely established under Ptolemy II Philadelphus in the 3rd century BCE. Didn't think you'd be getting a history lesson today, but you will be. Now, there's not much about the library that is still known. A lot of it remains a mystery, but it is still seen as the single greatest accumulation of human knowledge throughout history. And throughout its life, the library was burned no less than 3 separate times. Once by Julius Caesar in 48 BCE, once by Theophilus, the Patriarch of Alexandria, along with the Christian church around 400 CE, and finally in 640 CE by the Muslim ruler Caliph Omar, when the contents of the library were supposedly used as tinder for the city's bathhouses. Now, no matter which burning was truly the cause of the library's decline, one thing that can be agreed upon is that the destruction of the Library of Alexandria and the huge loss of knowledge that went with it significantly damaged our understanding of ancient civilization. So it kind of makes you wonder, what might have happened if the Great Library had survived and if all of the knowledge that was contained within it was still around today? Would the library continue to be a source of knowledge? A place where academics and students and travelers could go and learn more about the ancient world and the modern world? Or would that knowledge and the power that the library held eventually have become corrupted, taking control of the world and the people within it in a very, very dangerous and possibly confining way? So this is the world that author Rachel Caine explores in her book, Ink and Bone. And this is the first book of a 5-book series. It's called the Great Library series. And in this world that Caine has postulated, the Great Library of Alexandria has not only survived, but it has continued to grow. It has continued to gain knowledge, and it has continued to gain power. So in this world, the library now holds all of the world's knowledge. And all of this knowledge is contained in original book volumes, which are housed in the archive in Egypt. To control the flow of knowledge and to hold on to their power, the library has made it illegal to own original books. Instead, every citizen owns a tablet, or in this world, what's called a codex, where copies of originals can be synced from the originals in the archive. Very similar to an e-reader, if you have noticed that connection. Now, Caine's story starts very close to our own time. It starts in the year 2025 and follows a 10-year-old Jess Brightwell. And Jess is the son of a London merchant, quite well-off family, kind of respected in the community. But what a lot of people don't know is that they're also a book smuggling family. Now, it is Jess's job in this family to run illegal books through the city and deliver them to the people who purchase them. All the time he's doing this, he has to dodge the Garda or the police, who, if he was caught, would execute both him and the purchaser of the book. Now, Jess is very aware of this danger. He knows this danger very, very well because his older brother, Liam, not that long before, was caught and was executed. And Jess knows that if this happens to him, much like what happened to Liam, he won't get any help from his family. His family will deny any knowledge of him. His family will deny any connection to him so that they too are not stopped and they too are not killed. And so Jess knows that he doesn't really have any choice. He cannot get caught. So on one particular day, He's had a harrowing journey through London. He was almost caught by the Garda, but he finally delivers the book that he has to a wealthy gentleman in a coach. Before he knows exactly what's going on, the man unwraps the book, opens the book, looks at the pages, reverently takes one of the pages, rips it out of the book, puts it into his mouth, and eats it. Now, this book is an ancient manuscript by Archimedes, one that Jess has seen in his father's collection since he was a tiny, tiny child. He knows that this book on sphere making, there's no other book in the world like it. It is literally one of a kind. And this man has just ripped a page out and eaten it. Jess is shocked. Jess doesn't know what to do. He kind of stutters. He says, what are you doing? Why? And the man explains that to truly own the knowledge within the book and to own it so that nobody else can own that knowledge, you must consume the book. As a true book lover, Jess is a little bit astounded. He thinks this is damaging. He sees this as a perverse act, but he also knows that a wealthy man, a powerful man, can pretty much do whatever he wants. He bought the book. The book is now his, and there's nothing that Jess can do to stop him. So that is just the prologue of our story. Our actual story starts 7 years later when Jess is almost 17 years old. He's still a smuggler, but he's kind of become disinterested, dispassionate about the life, much because of this experience that he had with the man in the coach. And now he prefers to leave the smuggling to his twin brother, Brendan, and to his father. Instead, Jess likes to pilfer books from his father's collection and hide away to read them because he still loves books. He absolutely adores them. And he loves looking at originals. He loves to read originals. And so this is what he spends his time doing. That is until his father comes to him and says that Jess is a burden on their family. Well, he is the oldest twin. He's not in any place to take over the company. And Jess is not really useful for anything. And so his father says that unless he can be useful, then Jess is going to be thrown out of the house. So as a way to help him be useful, Jess's father has enrolled Jess to start training as a librarian at the Great Library in Alexandria. And once he has done his training and once he is in the library and he is established as a librarian, his father plans to use him as a spy and as a thief to further their smuggling enterprise. Now, Jess knows that if he is caught stealing or spying in the original archive of the Great Library, no questions will be asked. He will be executed and killed on the spot. However, he also knows that if he refuses his father, he'll be turned out on the street. And again, he'll have no means to survive. So he really doesn't see any other choice. So he begins his journey to Egypt, where he will become a postulante or a student and a spy. So when Jess gets there, there are 30 students in his class, all competing for just 6 positions within the library. They're taught by scholar Christopher Wolfe, and Christopher Wolfe is a hard, mean, and unforgiving person. After their first class, he locks the students in a sealed room with a very highly volatile and dangerous substance known as Greek fire. He gives them no clues that they are in danger. He gives them a very small window with which to escape the room from. Now, among his classmates, there is Cheery Thomas from Berlin, who Jess becomes best friends with. There's stuck-up Dario from Spain, who Jess has to share a room with. There's kind, smart, strong Kalia, who was the first person ever, not just the first woman, the first person ever to obtain a perfect score on the entrance exam. And there's Crabby Gline, who makes the current war between Wales and England much, much closer to home for Jess. So as the book goes on, we learn more about the connections between the students, the disagreements between the students. As one by one, the postulants start to fail out of this program. Jess continues to be worried and live in fear that he's going to be found out as a spy. And it's not until a new student, Morgan Holt, comes into the program that things start to change. Because Morgan has a secret too, and her secret is much bigger and much more dangerous than Jess's. So it kind of forces Jess to question who he can trust and makes him realize that there's much, much more to the Great Library than he realized. Most of the story is told from Jess's perspective. He's kind of the only point of view that we get, but we do get letters interspersed throughout the story, which I found really cool way to give information. The letters range from just letters in between our characters, as well as letters throughout history. And the letters throughout history give us an idea of what the library has done as an organization to get to where it is, what horrible things it has had to do to maintain the power that it has today and to keep that power. I really, really enjoyed this book. This was one that I actually had on my TBR for quite a while. And so this topic gave me a chance to finally read it. I listened to the audiobook of this one, and I know we've talked in the past about audiobook listeners and whether we stop as soon as our car stops or if we keep going. I didn't keep going, but I was very, very tempted multiple times to just sit in my car in the parking garage when I got home at night, but I didn't. When I first started reading, it was a little bit reminiscent of like Harry Potter or The Magicians, with the idea of like a magic school or some kind of school, and the kind of the focus being on the students going to the school. However, as the book went on, the students are sent away from the library. You kind of learn more about the history and the alternate world that Kane has created, more about the characters, more about all of their secrets. And I really appreciated that the story didn't just focus on kind of that one location and that one storyline. As I said, the letters were really cool because it allowed Kane to give a lot of information without just a lot of exposition, which is sometimes boring, and even important as it is, it's sometimes not the funnest thing to read through. Yeah, I thought it had a really good balance of character building and exposition and world building and adventure. And then it also pointed a very, very big and not a difficult to tell finger at the themes of freedom, every person's right to access information, and what happens when that right is taken away from you, and who has the right to have the information and to control the information, as well as what wealth and power gives to people. And the opposite side of that is what happens when you're not the people with the wealth and with the power. Overall, I found that the twists were a little bit predictable, but I don't think that it stopped me from enjoying the book. Kane was able to pull me into the suspense and the tension of the story anyways. So I didn't feel a huge loss from predicting what was going to happen. So that is Ink and Bone by Rachel Kane. I'm definitely going to look up the rest of the series. And if it sounds interesting, I recommend it.
Thank you so much, Sadie. That sounds fantastic. I am a huge sucker for books about libraries and librarians for obvious reasons. So might have to check that out. And that is all we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us for Keep It Fictional. And until next time, keep reading.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please tell a fellow book lover about it. You can find a list of all the books we discussed in our show notes. Join us next week for another fun book chat. Until then, keep it fictional.